Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Readers of the New York Times opened their paper to read a column by Nicholas Kristof that began this way. The most vicious ethnic cleansing you've never heard of is unfolding here in the southeastern fringes of the Sahara Desert. Now, he concluded on that day by saying, if we turn away simply because the victims are African tribes, people who have the misfortune to speak no English, have no phones, and live in one of the remote parts of the globe, then shame on us. Here's the thing, Nick wrote that column a year and a half ago. Since that time, people have started to pay attention to the fighting and the killing and the rape in Darfur, Sudan. Although not much has changed, the Sudanese government is so determined to block criticism, it recently arrested two top officials with Médecins Sans Frontières, as explained in this BBC News report.
MSF published a report which said it had treated nearly 500 victims of rape over a 4.5-month period. The Sudanese authorities demanded that the relevant medical records be released. When MSF refused, Sudan accused them of making up the report and arrested their country director.
Of course, we should continue to provide medical assistance to the people in Darfur and elsewhere, and we shouldn't be intimidated by this action.
And yet there are some reasons to hope the rebel groups and the government may have their first peace talks later this month. Nick Kristof is with us this hour. He's just returned from another trip to Darfur. We'd like to have you join the conversation. Is this a time when the U.S. and the rest of the world can do more to help the victims and shame the aggressors? Do you think more will and can be done by the international community? Or do you feel, as one of Nick's readers wrote him, that the U.S. should instead be taking care of its own? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Nicholas Kristof is an op-ed columnist with the New York Times and joining us from a studio in New York. Nick, it's nice to have you back.
Good to be back.
Four visits to Darfur in the time since you wrote back in the winter of 2004, is that right?
That's correct.
And just home a week ago.
That's correct.
I'm wondering if there is a scene or an image or something from your last trip to Darfur that you can share with us, which gives us that kind of intimacy with the story that you so clearly have.
Sure. I mean, it's that intimacy that keeps drawing me back. And let me tell you about just when I first walked into the Kalma camp near the town of Niala. This is a huge camp of 110,000 people. I knew that rape was a big issue there, but I'd also been warned that, you know, it is such a shameful thing and also so dangerous for women to talk about because they're being guarded by the same police who are doing the raping, that it'd be very difficult or impossible to get people to talk. Well, when I first walked in, I went over to a group of maybe 50 or 60 women and started talking. And after a little while, I asked the women about rapes, and I was blown away that in that little group, four women volunteered that they had been raped in four separate gang rape attacks in the last few months, and cases where they had really been severely injured, where they had to be fetched with a donkey. And if four women acknowledged that in that random group, it just made me think that kind of problem is endemic. And I was also, I must say, just incredibly impressed by their courage and willing to talk about this openly and also to put up with the risks of you know, being attacked again for speaking out. And it seems to me that if they were willing to speak out, you know, it's extraordinary that we're not.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that unusually for a print reporter, you're there with a camera. Some of what they tell you can be seen in the multimedia presentations that you're including as part of your columns. They're aware that they're doing this on camera as well, not just in some, you know, back corner of a camp where nobody's watching and names are being changed.
That's right. We had a large video camera there. There were police 30, 40 feet away. You know, but these women, I mean, on the one hand, they're incredibly shamed and humiliated. Some of them, after being raped, have to go off and build their own hut away from everybody else. So they're, I mean, the shame is real, but there's also a lot of anger there. And anger, you know, that this is allowed to go on, you know, 2 years after the genocide began in the supposed safety of a camp that, you know, has international support.
I mentioned earlier the MSF people, the leaders there in Sudan who've been arrested over the past couple of weeks, and that was in relation to a piece that they put out back in March called The Crushing Burden of Rape, Sexual Violence in Darfur. They note in that that over a 4-month period, they spoke to 500 victims of rape, just people who are in touch with MSFs. So this part of the story, regardless of if there's any good news here, that part's still not going away, I guess.
Right. And the other thing I'd just like to add is that, you know, those were 500 women who actually went to get medical treatment.
Right.
But most women don't go to clinics to get medical treatment. And part of that is, you know, just the general shame that attaches to it anywhere. But in particular, in Sudan, people don't go because the government has made a habit of trying to find out and punish those who do report rapes. And in two cases recently, women who went to get treatment after rapes were hauled out of the clinics by the police and forced to recant. And one of those women is she was chained to a hospital cot, then taken to a prison, and now she's facing possible charges for making false statements.
I should mention to our listeners that we, at our website, theconnection.org, we have links to Nick's work as well as his multimedia stuff. I wanted to bring up the MSF people, Nick, because that's a part of this of what's going on there that I don't understand. These are the leaders in Sudan of an organization that won the Nobel Peace Prize for its work in helping victims. They're arrested for saying things offensive to that government, but it didn't seem to change the sort of moral outrage or raise the level of that at all.
Well, I mean, I must say that it raised it a little bit. I mean, we're talking about it now. It did get some attention in Europe. But, I mean, the real penalties are borne not by the international aid workers, who by and large are okay. You know, I mean, these two MSF people, and I think they did great work. I mean,
right.
They were among the first to call attention to it. But, you know, in the end, they have been
they're out
released
on
their own recognizance.
Yeah.
They're out. They will probably end up being expelled. You know, but the real pain is borne by those Sudanese who are in the camps who have no recourse, and it may well be that as a result of this, MSF will get kicked out of Sudan or at least kicked out of Darfur, and then, you know, the end result will be an awful lot more dead Sudanese children.
Now, this is going to be an hour in which we talk about those people, but I do want to ask just quickly about yourself. If the aid people are being arrested for saying that kind of thing, how difficult is it for journalists to travel through Darfur and to tell stories? How hard is it for you to, for example, go back as you have several times?
I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, I've been basically blacklisted by the Sudanese. In the past, I went in illegally from Chad. I went to Chad and then paid drivers obscene sums to cross the border and just drive across the desert into Darfur. This time I was able to get a visa because I accompanied Kofi Annan into Darfur on his trip, and then I just jumped ship and didn't leave with him. And you know, it's always a problem with journalists. Sort of, you certainly don't want to mislead people. You don't want to tell a lie. In this case, I kind of pushed the limit a little bit because to get into the camp, aid workers had all these passes around their necks, and I took frequent flyer cards and put them on my sunglasses lanyards and dangled them around my neck. And the police at the outside of the camp, I mean, they couldn't read English. They saw my United Mileage Plus frequent flyer card, and you know, that was one way I got into the camp. We were very careful. We were warned that if people saw us filming, you know, that we would run into problems. But, you know, fundamentally, when journalists get into trouble, they're kicked out. When the locals get into trouble, then it becomes very serious. You know, the other thing I should also add is that I've been beating up on President Bush for not doing more, but I think the American media also, I mean, this has not been our finest hour covering Darfur. And it's true that Sudan has made it very, very difficult for us to get access, especially with TV cameras there. But you also know that, you know, if the Michael Jackson trial were being held in Darfur, every network would figure out a way of getting in there. You know, it's difficult, but when the issues are important enough, when we really attach priority to something, we figure out a way, and we haven't.
Was there something about this unfolding story over the past year and a half that drew you specifically, some reason why you've made it a point to go back and back? I mean, you're a columnist. You could sit in your office in Manhattan and noodle on about important or unimportant things in this country and still get your paycheck. Why Darfur?
Well, initially it was kind of, you know, an accident that I happened to go. I'd heard some horror stories from the area, initially from MSF. And so I went at the beginning of last year. And then I was just kind of blown away by what I saw. And, you know, the thing that I just maybe found most wrenching was in an area along the Chad-Sudan border, there were these families. In many cases, the husband had been already killed. You had a widow who was looking after a bunch of small children. And they had to get water from the well. And the Janjaweed militia would stand near the well, and they would shoot adults, kill men and rape women who went to the well. But often they would leave the children unscathed. And so these parents were in the position of having to send small kids, you know, six-year-old kids with a donkey to go get water from a well. And, I mean, they loved these kids, and they felt horrible for doing it, but it was the only way they could, you know, they could stay alive and get water to keep the rest of them alive. And, you know, I just talked to these people in that position, and it just struck me as such an excruciating choice, and one that we could make a huge difference on if we did speak out more. And that kind of that memory, and, you know, maybe thinking of what I would do in that situation, my own children, drew me back each time.
Connection listeners, Nick Kristoff is with us for this hour, and we'd like to have you join us on the subject of Darfur. Is this a moment? Is there a window now of opportunity for governments and for aid agencies and human rights organizations to turn up the heat, to bring down the level of violence and rape in Darfur? We'll talk more with Nick when we come back after the break, but we'd also like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Nick Kristoff is our guest this hour. He's op-ed columnist for The New York Times. He's been writing about the situation in Darfur for the past 2 years. He calls it genocide in the 21st century. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell called it genocide. President Bush repeated those words and called the situation genocide. Does that mean that more people should sit up, pay attention, get involved in trying to help the people who are there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Now, Nick, I heard you speaking with my colleague Melissa Block on All Things Considered last night, and part of that conversation, you were saying that there is a hint of good news, a whiff of optimism, I think you said. What is there to what's the good news from there?
There are a couple of things. One is that the international community has been willing to provide substantial amounts of aid, and so you don't have people starving in a way that, you know, seemed likely not so long ago. In fact, malnutrition rates are lower among a lot of the Darfur refugees than they are in other parts of Sudan. The second thing is that there is beginning to be kind of an outline of security being reestablished in a few areas with forces from the African Union. And every place that African Union forces have gone, even though they're tiny numbers, even though they're poorly equipped, the difference has been just phenomenal.
But they're only monitors, aren't they?
Villages.
Aren't they? These soldiers?
They started out with monitors. They do have a somewhat ambiguous protection mission, and now most of them are armed.
Okay. Tell me why it is with even at such small numbers they're able to make a difference there.
Well, part of it is that the Janjaweed, who, you know, are doing the most of the killing, the militia, you know, they are lousy shots. They're quite poorly armed. They don't want to have a fight with other people who do have guns. And so the pattern has been that where the African Union can establish even almost a token presence, then the Janjaweed kind of leave that area alone. And when you have the Darfur people who stray away to get firewood or to herd animals, then they risk being attacked. But you do have these kind of safety zones. And, you know, it's just striking what just a really tiny number of African Union forces have achieved. And you get the sense that if we had a really meaningful number, I mean, if we could have 15,000 or 20,000 on the ground there, you could really have hope that the Darfur would be a place again instead of a crisis. And likewise, you know, there are peace talks coming up. And in contrast to a lot of regional disputes, you don't get the sense that this is one that is insoluble. The rebels in Darfur are not asking, for secession or for independence. They simply want greater autonomy. It's, conceivable that one could have a peace deal by the end of the year. you know, if the international community really leaned on everybody, and if more security were provided, if food were provided, you know, you would manage to avert hundreds and hundreds of thousands of deaths.
I'm curious, though, if there is to be some kind of substance to the peace talks, wouldn't the Sudan government then have to at least acknowledge some of its involvement in the killing there? Because so far, unless I'm mistaken, they've really said to everyone making accusations, no, it's not us, leave us out of it.
Yeah, but, and, you know, There are going to be all kinds of difficulties in achieving a peace agreement there. And I must say that a lot of the problems or obstacles are going to be on the rebel side as well as the Sudan government. But if you look at what has been achieved in the deal between the north and south of Sudan,
right.
I mean, that seemed much, much more difficult to reach a deal on. And, in fact, a tentative outline of a deal has been achieved. And I think, you know, that gives me a certain amount of optimism that if we were to make it a priority in Darfur, as we did with the North-South peace, then we could have a deal there as well.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. John's with us on the line. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just can't get over the notion as a black person here in this country that if these were white Western Europeans or Eastern Europeans who were being raped, pillaged, and et cetera, that the American outrage and world outrage would be just profound.
Well, we did see some of that in the Balkans, and the outrage wasn't that great, you know.
Some, but I mean, ultimately, the United States did get involved there.
Yeah.
A lot more vociferously than it is now in Darfur. I mean, this is really something that speaks to our values and our reaction to it says a lot to the world about what we think is important.
Nick, I'm going to go back to you with your very first words from there. If these weren't African tribes people without English and without phones, would this be a different story by now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you imagine, if Anglophone Canadians were wiping out Francophone Canadians in Quebec, I mean, if these kinds of things were happening north of the border, I mean, just imagine the response. The one thing I will say is that one of the things that would galvanize us, and it's one of the things that galvanized us in the case of Bosnia and also in the case of the tsunami, is pictures. And, you know, when you get these images of women who've been mutilated, of kids who are orphans, when you get them on your television screen, it becomes a lot harder to turn away. And we don't have those images on our screen. I think most Americans haven't kind of identified with what is going on in Darfur and don't feel that kind of empathy for individuals that kind of gets them going. And,
Go ahead, John.
I mean, but even with the whole tsunami experience, it was because European tourists were involved in that. Once the tourists left, the tsunami visuals sort of went away on the screen too.
Is that your experience, John, with what's going on in Darfur, that you're not seeing it on television or reading about it in the papers in Chapel Hill?
No, I'm not. I mean, I read the New York Times, and I see the occasional story about this outrage or that outrage, but I mean, it's not the visual experience of, you know, 24/7 CNN all the time.
There's more about Michael Jackson than there is about Darfur.
Oh, hell yes.
Yeah. I must say that one of the things that strikes me about the visuals of it is that, on occasion I've been frustrated by just the lack of the power of my writing to get people to respond. And so on a couple of occasions, three occasions now, I've used pictures in my op-ed space. And, you know, it is amazing as a writer and a little bit depressing to see the difference that once you run a picture out there on the op-ed page, then all of a sudden, you know, people really respond. They feel sorry for those individuals. They want to help.
These were dead people in these pictures, too. These were not just sort of artfully composed photographs of people sitting under a tree somewhere.
Yeah. We agonized a little bit about, you know, what pictures to use. And they, you know, they weren't kind of nice, tasteful photos. But I felt that, you know, what is going on in Darfur isn't nice and tasteful, and you needed to give people some sense of just how awful it is on the ground. And indeed, that was, in fact, what got people to respond.
Let's take a call from Bedford, Massachusetts. Joel's joining us. Hi, Joel.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Nick, those pictures are what got me motivated, and I immediately wrote my congressmen and both my senators about what are they trying to do. And I got responses back from Kerry and from Tierney, but I never heard back from Senator Kennedy. But the question I have is, who has economic interests in this country in the Sudan? And why aren't we putting pressure on them to get the Sudanese government to behave well? And the other thing is, why are we allowing the Sudanese government to have an air force if that air force is used to support the Janjaweed? I mean, the French wiped out the Ivory Coast Air Force when it went and bombed one of their positions.
Let's start with the business angle on that, Joel, because I think it's an important part of the story.
Yeah, and the answer is that there are very few American financial interests, economic interests in Sudan. There have been some sanctions applied to Sudan, and so there's very little economic leverage or any other kind of leverage that we directly have over Sudan. What we do have is indirect leverage. China gets about 7% of its energy, of its oil, from Sudan, and China has a lot of influence. I think that we could do more to lean on China to put pressure on Sudan and to stop defending Sudan in the UN Security Council. And I think we can also put more pressure on Egypt to use its very considerable pressure on Sudan to get greater responsiveness there. In terms of you asked about the Air Force. I mean, that is, I think, one of the frustrating things that, it would
pipeline.
Be very easy to enforce a no-fly zone there. And it seems to me just absurd that 2 years on, we're still allowing Sudanese gunships and bombers to destroy villages, civilian villages in Sudan. It would be very cheap and cost-effective, not so much to knock down aircraft while they're still in the sky, but simply after a Sudanese bomber has destroyed a village, then for us to knock out that bomber, and the Sudanese would get the lesson right away.
1-800-423-8255 to Philadelphia next, and Joan is joining us from there. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I wanted to tell you about a website that was started by students at Williams College. It's SudanDivestment.com. It's an effort to get all of the states together to have their public funds divested from companies that do business with the Sudanese government.
I know, Nick, you've had some dealings with college students who have been organizing in different ways to try and add weight to this, right?
Yeah, and I must say I'm incredibly impressed with college students. They've kind of redeemed my faith in the country. I mean, in general, the U.S. has not been very responsive. University students have been a great exception, and campuses across the country really have been very active. And divestment has been one of the tactics they've chosen. It's principally been divestment of U.S. Investments in Chinese companies that do business in Sudan. I must say, normally I'm a great skeptic of divestment strategies. I think in the case of Burma, it's been a mistake. But in this case, I think that just the symbolic value and the degree of shame and attention that it calls to the issue, makes it very much worth it.
And John, what's your experience?
I'm actually from North Carolina, and I've got a bill in with my representative, and it's a study bill to divest our public funds. Illinois, California, New Jersey, and Arizona have all passed divestment legislation at this point.
Do you find, though, that people, ordinary people, are paying attention and getting behind it?
It's hard. I've been doing as much as I possibly can to make as many people aware, and it's hard because a lot of people have no idea. And shows like this, and Nick, thank you so much for the articles that you write. That's what we have to do. Just keep on finding as many outlets as we can.
Joan, help me with your own assessment of why that is the case. I can't believe it's because people don't care. I wonder if they can only care about so much, and so they look at the international section of the newspaper, check out what's going on in Iraq, and move on to the comics. I mean, what's your sense of this?
People don't know. I got together and spoke with a social ministry group and told them what was going on. UNC has adopted a refugee camp, and what we're doing is collecting school supplies for the kids. So I went over and talked to a social ministry program. They had no idea what was going on. As soon as they knew, we had bags and bags of items.
Nick, is that your experience, that people just don't know?
I think there's an element of that, but I do think that, you know, there is a perception that it's an awful long way away. I think also a lot of people think, well, you know, it's sure too bad about that, but Africa's always a mess. We have a lot of other, you know, we're busy in Iraq. I think that there's an awful lot of that feeling as well.
The other part of it, Nick, and I know you look at it from this perspective because I read your columns, and that is that there needs to be a certain degree of political leadership here. I look back over the pieces that you've written, and last fall you were saying, you know, look, America could do more, but President Bush has done more than just about any other leader, and his legacy will be hundreds of thousands of lives saved in Darfur. But I look at the writing this spring, and I see a much harder edge in your attitude towards the administration, listing the number of American presidents who watched, you know, massacres in Armenia and World War II in Cambodia and Bosnia, and saying, you know what, President Bush may be writing a new chapter there. What's changed?
I think part of it is that Colin Powell is no longer around, and John Danforth no longer around. Last year, the Bush administration, you know, was slow, but, you know, as you say, it wasn't as bad as it could have been. There were elements in the administration, like the Agency for International Development, that, you know, jumped on this right from the get-go, that pushed the White House to do more. And in fact, you can argue the White House was, you know, pushing the issue a little bit more than the Democrats initially, you know, ahead of John Kerry. And Colin Powell pushed it a lot. Later, John Danforth at the UN. And then, you know, the Bush administration just, I think, got the feeling that, you know, that's going to be a mess. I think Bush remembers Somalia and his dad's involvement there and thinks it's going to be thankless to do anything. And so you really began to see a retreat from the administration, less pressure placed by the administration on Sudan. I think Condi Rice cares about it an awful lot less than Colin Powell did.
You think if she just went there, it would make a difference?
I think it would make a huge difference. I mean, I think that, you know, it's true we don't have a lot of traditional levers over Sudan. But one of the most important levers we have and can ever apply is simply moral authority and pressure and shame. And one of the lessons, if you look back at past genocides, is that when you shine a light at something, then, you know, governments tend to be embarrassed about it. And in fact, you know, that's what's going on with MSF. The reason why they arrested these two MSF officials is that they're embarrassed about having mass rape going on in Darfur. And, you know, if Condi Rice were to go to Darfur with the network cameras all in tow, if she were to meet with a bunch of rape victims there, imagine, you know, the power of that scene. That, I think, would have a huge effect in getting the Sudanese government to rein in the rapes, and they can do that. And in fact, you know, whenever we have sort of raised the spotlight on Darfur a little bit, then the killings subside, the rape subsides, the burnings of villages subside. And on the other hand, when attention is diverted, for example, by the tsunami, then you get more of these attacks on villages. And, you know, that power to shame is simply a very important tool that we have not been applying.
One other person who watches this very closely is the Smith professor, Eric Reeves, and he's been on the program talking about his work. I know that you use his eye on this as well.
Right. And he's been a pioneer in this.
One of the things that Eric wrote recently is that we're seeing a drop off in violence simply because the Sudanese have basically hit all the targets they want to hit. Was that your impression when you went there as well?
Yeah, I mean, you drive around Darfur, and you know, you go village to village to village that has been burned out and abandoned, and you know, the people are either hiding in the hills, or they've moved to these, you know, vast shanty town refugee camps.
So has the government then achieved the ethnic cleansing, if that's what they intended in the first place? Is that the one part of this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are vast areas of Darfur that have now been, especially the countryside, that have now been completely ethnically cleansed. And, you know, I think it's possible to get people back, but it's going to be difficult to reverse that. And if we let the Sudanese government get away with it.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Nick Kristof is the op-ed columnist with the New York Times, who has just come back from his fourth trip to Darfur. He's here to take your questions. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. Nick Kristoff is my guest this hour. He's a columnist for The New York Times who's been writing about the situation in Darfur for the past 2 years. Straight back to the calls to Newburyport, Massachusetts. Frank's on the line. Hi, Frank.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
Good. I read Nick's columns with great pleasure often, whenever I've come across them in The Times. But listen, I have a question for him and a comment. And that is, it seems to me that, you know, I've been listening to this discussion now for the better part of a half an hour, and I haven't heard Nick or you or any caller mention the fact that we're dealing with an Islamic regime here, an Arab Islamic regime, and, you know, we're talking about the responsibility of the United States. You know, my goodness, where's Saudi Arabia? Where's Pakistan? Where are the people who tell us that Islam is a religion of peace and that it's mischaracterized as a violent, barbarian expression of some sort of weird cult? You know, we're always hearing that Islam is so great. Where are they? And why aren't they putting the pressure on? Why does it come down to the Chinese and the Americans when the Islamic community is sitting by apparently doing absolutely nothing about a bunch of Islamic Arabs going down and preying on black Africans who are also Muslims and butchering and raping them? I just don't get where our culpability is. And the second point I'd mention is we keep saying, well, we should be doing something. Well, you know, we are doing something in Iraq, and what we're getting is worldwide rebuke for uncovering mass graves and all the rest of the killings that went on there. I just don't see why it's up to the U.S. and why it isn't up to the Islamic community.
Stay on the line, Frank. I'm going to let Nick talk to you here.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm one of those people who has argued that Islam has been, you know, denigrated unfairly. But you're absolutely right that, you know, the government is an Islamist regime, and that the Islamic countries have, in general, been on the wrong side of this, the Arab countries in particular. Egypt, you know, is hugely important in Sudan, and Egypt has, by and large, been pretty much complicit in the genocide, and that largely includes the press, you know, in Egypt. There have been some Arab intellectuals in places like Lebanon who have spoken out passionately against what is going on in Darfur, but they've been a minority. And, you know, one reason is that everything that the U.S. does is very much seen through the filter of, you know, kind of another crusade, you know, attacks on the Arab world and so on. And I think that that attitude is partly inflamed by what happened in Iraq. But, you know, I mean, you're absolutely right that there needs to be much more pressure from the Arab world, I think Egypt in particular. Though, but, you know, you said that, you know, when we tried to do something in Iraq, then that that ended up hurting us. You know, in fact, I think one can make the opposite argument, that the U.S. image now has been so tarnished around the world that I think it would really help if we were to do something that is clearly humanitarian, and to the extent that we're not talking about sending American troops on the ground here, I don't think that would inflame sensitivities so much. And I think we would have, you know, enormous gain in our image around the world
if we were
pushing for, you know, to stop the genocide more forcefully.
Yeah, let me just say this. If we bombed their planes on the ground, as you suggested and said would be enormously effective, you know, I give it 6 weeks before there's a picture on the cover of the New York Times telling us that here are the three children that were killed by an errant U.S. bomb, and we'd be into the middle of, you know, 30 articles and editorials on how we didn't take care with this operation and all the rest of it. It's a thankless task, and much as I sympathize with your point of view and much as I'm outraged by what's going on, what the U.S. needs like a hole in the head is one more commitment, even if it was only supporting African troops in an Islamic situation. As far as I'm concerned, you know, we have tried this in Iraq. We have tried this in Afghanistan. What we're left with is 1,000 stories about prisoner abuse and a tarnished image. You know, that may be partly the media's fault. But nonetheless, you know, this is a dangerous, difficult world. And until people, columnists like you and the paper you work for, like the New York Times, start regularly beating the drum on the inhumanity being perpetrated by an Islamic regime that is going basically unreported in Saudi Arabia and other Muslim countries. You know, we've got outrage over the mishandling of a Quran at Guantanamo and 17 or 18 people killed in Afghanistan, and yet, you know, Muslims slaughter each other every day all over the world.
Okay, but Frank, let's bring it back to the point here. Are you saying that the and Are you saying that it's just not worth getting involved in a place like Darfur? And are you saying that it's not worth getting involved because the issue's not worth it, or that it's just going to mean bad publicity for the United States?
I'm saying that our political responsibility would be to really lean heavily on people like the Egyptians and the Saudi Arabians to put up or shut up when it comes to their talk about Islam being a peaceful religion and a religion of human rights. You know, so far this has been nice propaganda, but what we do not see is anyone taking care of any of this in their backyard. It's a little bit analogous to the French and the Germans who did not manage to do much in their own backyard in Kosovo and Bosnia, and eventually we had to get involved. But I really think the U.S. and our writers, our columnists, our newspaper of record, whatever, should be placing a lot more emphasis on putting the responsibility on the people who are closest to the situation, in this case closest ideologically, because somehow Islam and this sort of violence seems to be inextricably bound up, and we need to be honest and politically incorrect about calling it as we see it.
I mean, I think you're right that we should be putting more pressure on Egypt to do more. But, I mean, frankly, the reality is that Egypt may become less supportive of Khartoum, but it's not going to stop what is going on. And so if we choose not to become involved because, it's not in our backyard and it should be Egypt's responsibility, then, you know, at this moment there would be maybe a million dead instead of, a few hundred thousand. And so the choice from our point of view is, granted that others should be doing more, but they're not going to. Do we just want to go ahead and let hundreds of thousands of people die? And I do think that it's a mistake to equate our involvement in Darfur, or what we should be doing in Darfur, with either Iraq or Afghanistan, because those did involve, American troops on the ground. Partly because of Iraq, we should not be sending American troops into Darfur. I mean, that would be a mistake. But I think our failure to speak out forcefully, it seems to me is a huge mistake, and is one that is costing a lot of lives of, kids on the ground in Darfur.
1-800-423-TALK. Next to Albany, New York, and Father Bob Graham is with us. Hi. Hi, Father Bob.
Hi. Just recently, a parishioner of ours came back from Sudan. The Archdiocese of Albany has a very active interest in Sudan and has sent people down there. And one of the things that is concerning is that any agreement with the Sudanese government suddenly becomes the Sudanese government with Saudi Arabia pouring money into areas to build all the things that they need so badly, on the contingent that these people become join Islam. The problem is that once they do that, they look around and they say, you're not really our color. So this comes down to not only a religious thing, but this comes down to a race thing. And you can see that as
Father Bob, are you talking about the people who are in the Darfur area? Are you talking about the Christians who are living in southern Sudan?
I'm talking about the Christians living in southern Sudan, because the pattern there will be the pattern in Darfur, I believe, that whatever is needed will be suddenly given in with Chinese money and with, I'm afraid, Canadian money and with Saudi money to build more and more Arabic Islamic schools, hospitals, and so on.
Nick, is there a parallel there, a sort of Islamification?
Not really. In Darfur, everybody is Muslim. Both the perpetrators and the victims are Muslim. There, it's essentially a race or ethnic issue between Arab Muslims who are doing the killing for the most part, and non-Arab Muslims, African tribal Muslims, mostly from three different tribes, who are at the receiving end of the genocide.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join my conversation this hour with Nick Kristof. He's back 1 week from traveling in Darfur. Next to Raleigh, North Carolina, Craig's with us. Hi, Craig.
Nick, thanks for your writing. Thanks for the show, Dick. Another great one. I, like a lot of people of conscience, feel paralyzed, feel like we want to do something and feel paralyzed. Nick, if you were to pick one or two things, let's say someone would have time and a certain amount of money, not just send a note to President Bush or senators, what you would say some of the United States should do? Feels like this country's been given a lot, so we should be responsible for these kind of genocidal acts. What would you tell us to do?
I think there are a few things. On the purely humanitarian side, if one wants to donate, I mean, there are a lot of groups that are doing great work there. I mean, MSF, Doctors Without Borders, which we talked about before, is just, you know, doing great stuff on the ground, saving lives wholesale every day. So are groups like the International Rescue Committee and a whole gamut of them. On the advocacy side, which I think is crucial to, you know, to establishing security there, to stopping the slaughter, not just providing Band-Aids, but actually stopping the injuries, then I think that, you know, it's a function of contacting one's members of Congress, for example. There was legislation that passed the Senate earlier, the Darfur Accountability Act, and that should have been, you know, should have become law. Under administration pressure, it was blocked. You know, I think that if there had been more popular pressure, that would have become law. It would have, for example, have taken steps toward a no-fly zone. And the administration blocked it, you know, because there wasn't it wasn't getting a lot of protests from the public. During the 94 genocide, Senator Paul Simon said that, you know, if I think what he said was if 100 people from each congressional district had written to their member of Congress to say we got to do something, that would have made the difference. And
in Rwanda,
I think that,
right?
In Rwanda.
Yeah.
And I think the same is true now in Darfur, that, you know, there's nobody who's arguing sort of in favor of genocide. So it's just a matter of mustering enough people to argue against it, to argue that we need to take some, you know, modest action against it that would get something like the Darfur Accountability Act through. And you know, there are a bunch of efforts to try to build up that accountability. If you Google Darfur, you'll see a bunch of websites that are, you know, doing great stuff on that.
I want to go back to the call that we had from Frank in Newburyport, kind of as a contrast to what Craig was just saying and what Father Bob was saying about a different part of Sudan, and ask you, Nick, if you sense kind of a weariness in this country about, you know, always having to be the nation that goes in to fix stuff and never getting the credit for doing it, even when, you know, American lives are put at risk. I know that you wrote about a reader who sent you a letter saying why should the U.S. care for the rest of the world, and I'm not sure if in the mailbag or the email that you get there's a lot of that you're seeing now.
Yeah, there's a huge amount of it, and I think it's specifically directed at Africa. You know, the sense that Africa is hopeless, that it has been a mess, that it continues to be, you know, that it's not our fault. So, you know, when we have all these problems at home, why should we be reaching out to help people over there? And that it's, you know, it's sure it's unfortunate, it's a tragedy, but, you know, it's not our tragedy. And, I mean, of course, there were, you know, very similar attitudes that were directed toward every past genocide from Armenians, you know, in the beginning, during World War I, to Jews in the Holocaust, to Cambodians, to Rwandans, to Bosnians. You know, that perception that it's something happening a long way away, that it's very unfortunate, but that we don't have any, you know, there's no maximalist solution, so we don't end up even pursuing a minimalist option. I think, you know, we're making that same mistake today.
And the other recent news story that I did want to just hear a word from you on, because you were there while it was unfolding, is news from the International Criminal Court that they're going one step further. Rather than just taking a list of suspects from the UN to investigate, that they're actually opening this investigation. Now, word from Khartoum is that they're not going to have anything to do with it. But when it comes to raising the level and shaming a government, is that likely to make much of a difference here?
Yeah, I think it actually already is. And, I mean, to me, the importance of getting the International Criminal Court involved isn't so much, you know, the question of accountability, but it's really more a question of, you know, that sort of shining a spotlight on it and discouraging the Sudanese government from its past policies. And I think we're seeing that. You do get a sense that Sudan is embarrassed to some degree by what is going on. That's, you know, why it did arrest these MSF officers, and that, you know, that may be why the attacks have slowed to some degree. So I think that it's working. It just needs an awful lot more pressure, and I wish that President Bush, you know, were willing to do that instead of, you know, the problem is that he declared it to be genocide, and that kind of amounted as a substitute for action instead of as a spur to action.
Time for one quick last call from Natick, Massachusetts, and Joe's on the line. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. What do you think?
I had an editor, the editor published over the winter in the Boston Globe that called on Germany to play a role in ending this genocide, since they were the perpetrators of a past genocide. And I got a nice note from the German consulate thanking me for my opinion, but a little more than that. And the question that I have is, what role do our allies have? What pressure can we put on our allies? If they won't help us in Iraq, can we start to pressure them to help us here?
Principally Europeans is what you're talking about, Joe?
For the most part, yes.
I think that I think we could do a lot more. France in particular has played a particularly unhelpful role in Darfur. Britain has been quite good. The rest of Europe has, you know, generally been unhelpful, but not an obstacle. I think that, you know, one of the real advantages to pushing Darfur more with Europe would not just be that we could get them to be more involved, but also that it would rehabilitate the image of the U.S. In Europe, that, you know, right now so many young Europeans think of the U.S. in terms of what's going on in Guantanamo, in terms of abuses in Afghanistan or Iraq. And if we were to exercise real leadership in Darfur, which is something that Europeans kind of care about but peripherally and don't really know what to do with, but and is an area that is just natural for American leadership, then I think that would go, you know, a substantial way to improving and burnishing the American image in our traditional allies.
Even though it should be enough to do it just because the people there need the help.
Absolutely.
Nick, I want to thank you for spending an hour with us. I appreciate your time.
I'm happy to. Thanks.
Nick Kristof is an op-ed writer for the New York Times, and just a reminder for our listeners, if you want to take a look at some of Nick's writings, you'll see links to his columns and to the New York Times interactive features on Darfur. Find all the links, I should say, at our website. We're at theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Sarah Baker, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Doug Sugarts, and Mary Stack, with help from Addie Goss and Maura Kelly. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.